Welcome to the latest edition of the Insurer's Best Policy podcast. My name is Christopher Munro, and today I'm joined by Michael Millett, a founder and managing partner of Hudson Structured Capital Management, an alternative asset manager for reinsurance and transportation-linked assets based in Connecticut and Bermuda. In this two-part interview, we discuss what is driving the current interest from investors in the insurance and reinsurance market. We consider the potential for new sidecars to be formed, and how carriers looking to establish them will need to create mechanisms to untrap capital quickly, as well as the general appeal of the insurance and reinsurance industry to investors at present. But we begin our conversation by considering the recent spate of equity raises for existing platforms, the so-called Class of 2020 newcos being formed.
We're seeing a material amount of equity being offered to investors, at least six startups or partial startups. In one case, it's an existing company that is adding a Bermuda company. And together, they are seeking to raise over $4 billion, as well as about eight secondary equity raises by existing companies, also totaling about $4 billion. So we already have more than $8 billion of equity raises visible. And that is a big sum. It's starting to get to be on par with the sums that we saw after 9/11. And to exceed the sums that we saw after the 2005 hurricanes. We think that this is an interesting time to raise equity and to raise newcos. The reason to create newcos is that they can bring talent, technology, fresh balance sheets to bear on a situation where the existing industry may be preoccupied. That was true after 9/11. We saw a whole series of very successful newcos, and in general, they developed into vibrant companies, some of which are still around, some of which have merged. We are seeing some great talent from past companies appearing at the helm of these newcos. They are pursuing broad-based platforms. These are not just natural cat reinsurers. They're pursuing E&S, they're pursuing broad-based reinsurance, they're pursuing reinsurance in the market, in the London market, in the capital markets. So these companies are seeking to add broad-based platforms to the industry. It's been a long time since the last class of newcos, about 15 years. So arguably now it is time when talent would seek a fresh outlet, when fresh perspectives may be brought to bear on problems. So I think it's not surprising to see newcos. I think that they may play a really important role in helping the industry to roll forward. The existing companies in the industry raising equity are doing it both offensively and defensively. You know, defensively, they're making sure that they're well stocked with capital. Offensively, you know, the opportunities across multiple markets are interesting.
Okay, thank you. One of the questions, I mean, you mentioned that there were six startups there and eight further equity raises with a total of about $8 billion together. Do you think there will be more coming to the fore as well in the next few weeks, months, et cetera, before the end of the year? Is there an expectation to see more of these or more of this happening?
I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not reflecting any undisclosed knowledge or hearsay, but I wouldn't be surprised to see more. The equity raises and the newcos that have appeared so quickly that maybe people will continue to think about the situation and will offer more. In fact, there are lines of business that have had large losses that won't necessarily be addressed by these newcos, lines of business like workers' comp and trade credit. So maybe we will see more newcos in those areas or more equity raises in those areas.
So sort of in business line specific type entities, perhaps.
Or maybe broad-based companies with specific emphases.
I mean, you mentioned of a sort of new class of business then. So there is an expectation, you do believe that there will be a sort of newly formed class of 2020 being created by year end then?
There already is a newly formed class of 2020. I expect that most of the newcos that are announced will go off. Usually people make announcements when they already have some degree of certainty that that's going to be the case. So we will have a class of 2020. It's visible now. Okay. It'll be interesting to see how they refresh the insurance paradigm. Let's keep in mind that NewCos are a long-standing part of this industry. We had the class of 92, and they refreshed the industry by introducing the freestanding Bermuda Property Stock Company. They refreshed the industry by investing newly in cap models. We had actually the earlier class of the 1980s in Bermuda that refreshed the industry with fresh approaches to liability insurance and different forms of financial insurance. The class of 01 refreshed the industry's approach to E&S. Arguably, I think the insurtechs can be viewed as a class of newcos, and they've brought about a fresh approach to technology. A true class of newcos is not just a bunch of capital appearing on the scene. True class of newcos is going to bring a fresh approach in the industry to the industry's issues. It'll be interesting to see how this class develops.
Do you have any thoughts on what those sort of new ways of thinking that the class of 2020 might bring? I mean, what areas do you think would be particularly sort of ripe for change and you think that they would seek to address at the moment?
The industry needs to address its expense base. The industry needs to embrace technology afresh. The industry has embraced technology in the past, but at the moment there's a new generation of technology for the industry to seize upon. Those are a couple of ways that these newcos may address this opportunity freshly.
There's also been talk of sidecars and new sidecars being formed or potentially existing ones sort of expanding and what have you. What is your take on that? Is that something you expect to materialize?
Well, I think that there is a great deal of interest in issuing sidecars. I think that many companies would like to have temporary additional equity, which is what sidecars are, after all. Mm-hmm. Sidecars allow an existing platform to write additional business and to generate some fee-for-service profitability from it, and also allow that capacity to naturally fade away once the opportunity has also faded away. Sidecars are always a more flexible tool than an equity raise, where once you raise additional equity, buying back shares down the road is a more expensive endeavor. The issue that the sidecar market is going to face is buyers. The main buyers of sidecars in the aftermath of Katrina, Rita, Wilma, which was the first big class of sidecars, were hedge funds and private equity funds. And I'm not sure that there's deep appetite in non-industry specialized hedge funds, nor in non-industry specialized PE. So some sidecars will find an audience there, but not to the extent that they did in 05, 06, when capital markets were red hot and when investors were looking for alternatives. There are wonderful opportunities across broad capital markets right now for those same investors. There was a second generation of sidecars that went primarily into insurance-linked funds. There was one large fund in particular that was specialized in sidecars. But that sort of fundraising and those sorts of funds are not as open right now. So the issue with the sidecar market is going supply-demand imbalance. There's going to be a great deal of desire to issue, and we will have to see how much take-up there is. I think that what is likely to happen is sidecar terms will shift materially from issuer-friendly to investor-friendly. I think that issuers that want to get off sidecars should be proactive, and they should also be thinking about creating crisp, constructive mechanisms to untrap capital quickly, because that's what investors are worried about right now.
And just sort of more broadly speaking, what is it in your view that's really driving investor appetite at the moment in the sort of insurance and reinsurance industry? And there is a lot of talk about investor interest in the space. So what's that stemming from in your eyes?
Investors are interested and they are wary. They're interested because one of the most important and attractive features of insurance-linked investments is low correlation to broad capital markets. And investors just suffered a terrifying 4 months of correlation in the capital markets, in which market after market collapsed with amazing speed. So investors will be valuing non-correlation even more highly than they have in the past. But there's wariness. We are now in the bulk of capital markets engagement in insurance-linked investments is in natural catastrophe, and we are in the fourth year of important natural catastrophe experience. Over those 4 years, starting in 2017, we have seen perhaps $175 billion of major catastrophes. And the source of the wariness is that the majority of those losses arise from neither wind nor shake. Traditionally, investors have understood themselves in nat cat markets as taking wind and shake losses, wind meaning hurricane. And they have understood the risk by looking at centuries of data, and they have felt that they could understand that. But starting with Harvey, we had a series of events that generated losses, in the case overwhelmingly in Harvey and in a large part in Irma, from water, and furthermore, in large part from Florence in the following year. And then losses from fire in several years of epic California wildfires. Mm-hmm. And then from business interruption this year. And lastly, to the extent that any riot losses creep into programs. Investors have begun to wonder whether they have thought about all of the ways that they could lose, whether those are all being quantified correctly, whether their expected returns and expected losses are being assessed correctly. They will be demanding from their managers and from the modelers in seeking to understand that.
So do you think there might be an emergence of sort of investors, more of a focus on peril-specific type, like investors only get participating on very peril-specific type coverages or products?
If you go back to the earliest days of the catastrophe bond market, transactions were typically named peril. Actually, they were typically single peril. As the market grew and as investor demand developed, and especially in the period of rapid growth and low catastrophe incidents from the passing of Hurricane Wilma to the onset of Hurricane Harvey, that coverage tended to broaden out to match the traditional reinsurance industry to be all perils, including but not limited to. That was a typical formulation across catastrophe contracts, certainly in the collateralized reinsurance market and in sidecars, and as well to some extent even in the bond market. The investors will refocus on that formulation. They will be more focused on named perils, and they'll be more focused on losses within named perils. Keep in mind that some of the losses over the past few years were driven by hurricanes, but they were driven by hurricane flood as opposed to hurricane wind. They were driven by hurricanes, but they were driven by post-hurricane loss adjustment and loss inflation as opposed to the apparent losses at the time of the hurricane. You know, keep in mind that for the bulk of the domestic Florida homeowners insurers, their losses essentially doubled from the quarter following Irma to today. So investors will be more demanding about named perils. They'll be more demanding about post-event inflation. There has been a fresh interest in parametric coverage, indexed coverage as a result of this.
You mentioned Florida there, and I'd like to come back to Florida to later on. Just a couple of comments. I mean, there was talk of equity researcher Morningstar said a few weeks ago that now is arguably the best time to invest in insurance in the insurance industry since the September 11th terrorist attacks, discounting any potential losses that may arise from COVID-19 business interruption losses, etc. What is your take on that? Do you think that's a fair assessment? Is now the best time to invest in insurance and reinsurance since 9/11?
On a broad basis, absolutely. I was active in the market in 05, 06, and I was active in the market after 9/11. I was active in the market for years and years before that. This is arguably one of the best times to invest in the broad-based reinsurance market in quite a long time. And the reason for that is, first of all, we rolled into COVID-19 with a reinsurance market that was already hardening in several places. It was already hardening in catastrophe risk because of the storms and fires of 17, 18, and 19. It was hardening because of the restructuring at Lloyd's and in certain U.S. companies that was driving non-elemental property losses wider. It was hardening because casualty insurers were seeing the onset of alternative litigation finance. So we were already in a hardening property and casualty market before we knew that we had a pandemic. The pandemic itself, we expect, has generated perhaps $80 billion of losses. Those insured losses have occurred in maybe in descending order in the following lines of business: in trade credit, workers' comp, other casualty lines of business, specialty property, natural catastrophe through business interruption, mortgage insurance, as well as on the asset side of the business and in certain parts of life health. The breadth of that loss and the scale of that loss will take a market that was already hardening and will accelerate the hardening. In addition, we're seeing companies raise equity, and that should generate some concern. Will too much be raised? We saw that after 2017. But I'd submit that the companies raising equity are the most likely to be disciplined, and that the new companies will be forcibly disciplined by their quite active investors. So this is a really interesting time to invest in the industry. We saw that from the 9/11 companies. The 9/11 companies as a group performed very well, and they had a broad market to select business from.
Moving away from sort of the broader investment market coming into the industry and looking specifically at Hudson Structured, you've been very active but you've been notably active in some certain areas of investment in the past few months. Towards the end of last year, you led a funding round for CyberCube, and that's been followed up by further sort of investments in insurtechs, both in Corvus and then title insurance specialist States Title. You touched upon the insurtech space earlier on and expenses and trying to drive down those costs. But what opportunities do you think exist in the insurtech space? And how is that sector developing and evolving? It seems to go through certain stages of evolution over time. Be curious to hear what state of evolution you think it's at, or stage of evolution it's at now, and what other opportunities there are out there in that space.
We were in an environment of opportunity for insurtech. And coronavirus created issues for some insurtech companies, but in general is likely to be a digital forcing event that will expand those opportunities ultimately. Mm-hmm. So why were we in an environment of opportunity for insurtech? First of all, the first question about insurtech is, why did insurtech fail for 20 years? I was in the industry in the late 1990s. Goldman Sachs equity analysts prepared an equity analysis report that showed the websites of all the insurance companies, because those websites were soon going to become portals and sites of great traffic and opportunity, which didn't happen. Part of the reason that InsurTech did not take off earlier is that so much of the intuition around the usefulness of InsurTech was around distribution. The industry, the venture community, the insurtech startups themselves had a deep intuition that insurance distribution was expensive, could be much more efficient if it all became electronic. And the companies, the insurtechs, tried and tried again. And consumers and businesses never quite budged, never quite jumped into a digital future in insurance distribution. And, you know, I've talked about this before. In the end, it's not a big surprise as to why this failed over and over. Insurance buying, whether it's an individual or a corporation, involves somebody sitting down, thinking of all the bad things that can happen to them, trying to quantify those and price them, develop legal documents that effectively contain and convey rights around those events. And then at the end of that process involves sending money to somebody that you hope will never pay you back again. Those are four things that nobody on earth wakes up wanting to do. And it's no surprise that people weren't hopping in front of their computer and buying all sorts of insurance online. Essentially, people need to be cajoled by their agents or by their risk managers or by their brokers. And the human agency in insurance played an important role. The current generation of insurtechs has addressed distribution more creatively, more cognizant of these needs. In many cases, insurtechs are addressing empowering the agent rather than trying to disintermediate the agent. Corvus is an example of a company that does that through Crowbar. Insurtechs are also taking advantage of the ability of technology to develop very highly customized products and to manipulate vast amounts of data. Companies that provide healthcare consumers with an online healthcare wallet with their information, and that allows that information and the doctor in front of them to interact to provide diagnostic advice. That's not something bricks and mortar medical care can do, but online medicine can do. They can use data to charge for insurance by the mile, an innovative scheme that became even more timely when half the people in America found their cars sitting in their driveways for months on end because of coronavirus. And so InsurTech is addressing a broader array of opportunities, empowering agents, developing new coverage models, providing claims management and underwriting tools. And we're seeing these efforts gain real traction. We think that coronavirus, by forcing both consumers and companies to connect with each other online, is likely to accelerate the development of some models. It's also going to create problems for some companies because it interrupts their fundraising. But the digital forcing event that coronavirus was is powerful.
Fantastic. I think one of the other, just linked to that, I mean, that's, you mentioned the distribution side of things there, but I think one of the really interesting things that's come up through coronavirus and the lockdown associated with it has been the surge in take up of electronic trading. That's most notable, I suppose, in London and how this sort of seemingly seamless sort of transition has been. I know some companies found it quite difficult to begin with, but that there's also been times progressed that seems to have, those hurdles seem to have been dealt with, and the companies are continuing to trade and businesses continue to be placed. Do you expect to see a sort of continued surge in sort of electronic trading and startups and technological platforms, and I guess insurtechs helping to support the back office? And we might start seeing more of a focus on those now with the adoption of electronic trading having sort of been taken up more widely.
When I say that coronavirus is a digital forcing event, what I mean is that perforce, people have had to use electronic tools to do things they couldn't do face-to-face. The industry has been fond of face-to-face models, and I outlined before there are reasons why people prefer to talk about and insure risk face-to-face. But having had the experience of doing that electronically, I think that the resistance to doing things will break down, and a lot more business will be transacted electronically. For example, Lloyd's has spent years trying to force a certain amount of their business online, and this has been a forcing event. I think it's very likely that a great deal more of Lloyd's will be online than would otherwise have been the case. I've heard from life insurance companies who have been seeking for years to have agents file online that they are succeeding now because of necessity. What does a digital forcing event mean? Mother knows how to order groceries on Instacart and do Zoom phone calls. It's amazing to me. I don't know how she does that on a flip phone, but that never would have happened except for this virus. And she will adopt those technologies, and so will life insurance agents, and so will folks at Lloyd's.
I think one of the most interesting things that sort of come out from it is how technology may actually improve so the whole underwriting process and impose more strict underwriting discipline. A couple of brokers have said to me one of the things they found quite frustrating is that underwriters find it far easier to decline business when it's done over a phone rather than being done face to face. That's another sort of positive, perhaps, that may come out of it going forward.
Well, there's that, and another that may come out of it is by transacting electronically, differences in wordings are more apparent. I think that many companies are now startled to discover the diversity of wordings in their policy books, which affects their claims experience and potential claims experience due to business interruption caused by coronavirus. So that will be another factor that will drive companies to seek to transact more online.
You mentioned Lloyd's there a couple of times, and just talking more generally about the London market, Hudson Structured itself has made couple of notable investments in London market companies in recent months, or London market platforms in recent months. You backed R&Q's 100 million equity raise, while Hudson Structured was also the lead capital provider to AIG's new syndicate 2019 at Lloyd's. Can you give us some of the some insight into the thinking behind those investments and sort of what drove your interest in those platforms?
Well, first of all, we invest broadly across the entire insurance and reinsurance space, and the London and Lloyd's markets are an important part of that. We've been active in that market for years. We, for example, are the largest owner of Ockham, which is a significant MGA in space, energy, nuclear, and cyber in the London market. So this is not new, this activity in London. In addition, we believed before coronavirus that the Lloyd's market had instituted significant reforms, and that those reforms had made many lines of business more attractive than they had been, and relatively attractive. Coronavirus has caused, according to Lloyd's own estimate, over $4 billion of losses in the market. That will drive, we expect, further hardening and further discipline, and will make business generated in that market more attractive. Lloyd's is set up to handle certain risks in an efficient way, and we will seek to invest in that efficiency. So you mentioned one Lloyd's market investment that we had made. In the case of R&Q, the issue has less to do with the London market per se than the fact that R&Q is located historically in London. R&Q is part of a different sector that we think is interesting, which is legacy casualty. We should also talk about that.
Thank you, Mike. That brings to an end the first half of the Insurer's Best Policy podcast interview with Mike Mallett, founder and managing partner of Hudson Structured Capital Management. The second part of the interview will be aired later this week and covers topics such as the continued evolution of the insurtech market, Hudson Structured's own recent investments in platforms such as R&Q and AIG's Syndicate 2019 at Lloyd's, and the potential fallout from the COVID-19 outbreak on the insurance and reinsurance industry. For now, though, it's time for me, Christopher Munro, to thank Mike for his time, and to you, our listeners, for joining us. Be sure to tune in later this week for the next installment of the Best Policy Podcast.